Good morning. Please state your appearances for the record.
Chair Lawrence Isaacson for Mr. Smith, who is not present today in custody.
Thank you. Good morning. Please be seated. Mr. Isaacson, you're ready?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. May it please the court, in this case, my client was assaulting, kidnapping, and robbing a young woman. In this case, this is an identification case, very strongly turned on that. The alleged victim was assaulted behind her at night. Once pressed, briefly saw the person who assaulted her. Her glasses were knocked off. Her head was slammed against the concrete, causing substantial injury. In the photo lineup she was given the second one, she not only did not identify the defendant, but identified another person. And testified at trial, she believed she identified the right person. Here we suggest this is a weak identification case. And in support of this, the only two pieces of evidence that were entered in here in terms of physical evidence of any kind were the photograph of a package of Pall Mall cigarettes taken from the defendant's belongings without warrant from his residence, the same brand the victim said were taken from her that night, and also a credit card from the victim's name taken again without warrant, taken from a trash can of the residence of the defendant.
Counsel, there was also testimonial evidence from other witnesses, isn't that correct?
Your Honor, there was a statement made to the residents of the apartment that he had confessed to at least possibly robbing her or assaulting her. That was contradicted by, I believe, his girlfriend, Ms. Ortiz. But in terms of physical evidence, the only pieces of evidence that were put in were the actual credit card, the bent credit card, and the photograph of the package of Pall Malls that was found in his belongings and taken to police headquarters in Melbourne. Those two pieces of evidence in this case, because it's really just an identification case, and there were some issues that was just mentioned, it was dark, it was at night, she only saw him briefly. These are very important corroborating pieces of evidence.
It was just a photo of the cigarettes, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
They were actually returned? The actual cigarettes were returned?
Judge, I don't recall. I know they were not kept. I know the detective testified.
So it was just the photo of it?
Just the photograph was added in evidence in this case of the photographs. And the other things that were taken from the, I think, three bags. There was an overnight bag, another type of bag, and a peach and purse were the things that were taken from a room of the defendant with Ms. Ortiz.
Okay.
Thank you. Our position is,
but just to clarify, there was nothing in the overnight bag or the other bags that was
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Used.
That was the sole piece of the jewelry that was taken from her was not found there. There are a number of different personal items that she had. There was an earring, there was a necklace that was ripped off, other items. You know, my understanding that nothing else was linked to the alleged offense except the cigarette.
Okay, so as far as the entry into the bedroom, we're talking about the cigarettes. Is there anything, any testimony related to the cigarettes that you would also argue that should be stricken? Did say by the police or?
Well, the testimony that we have from the legislature is that she said she had a Pall Mall cigarettes upon her.
Okay.
So she testified. She did not tell the police that. We also have testimony, I believe, of Alexis, who testified that the defendant had Pall Mall cigarettes upon him when he got into the car and they picked him up that night. Then we also have the testimony, then we have that they went to his house, the apartment 769 Lakeview Drive. That's when they came in and they seized his items. The testimony of the officer is they went in there and was given instructions to get the possession of the defendant to get them, and that's what he did. He came in there, he says, where is this room? It's in here. He's staying with the kids, and the kids' room right there. Pointed to it, took him in there, here's the stuff, and they took him. Our position is you simply cannot do that. You simply cannot just take somebody's possessions when they're a guest in someone's home.
Consent of Alexis, but not consent by the defendant in this situation.
I believe that decision, Your Honor, states very clearly an overnight guest was guaranteed the right to privacy in the host's apartment, even though the host consented to a search. He simply has rights. These rights are there for a reason.
Mr. Isaacson, there was no objection at trial to the admission of the photo of the Pall Mall cigarettes, right? So we are dealing with the plain error review.
Yes, Your
That's clear. That's clear from your brief and from the state's brief as well. So in that context of the plain error review, maybe you could speak to that. What should be our considerations, and what weight does the other evidence play in our plain error review analysis?
Well, Your Honor, clearly, both sides of the Metcalf decision, which is a recent Supreme Court case, and that talked about objections to the admission of incompetent evidence which a party failed to raise at trial, generally not subject to plain error review, cited in the lawsuit. However, for the ends of justice requirement and fundamental rights would otherwise be denied, only then will there be a departure from these principles. Metcalf is a situation where the objection was made to the admission, expert witness and a forensic witness for the state and an expert medical doctor came in without objection. The Metcalf case said, well, this doesn't go far. We're not going to use plain error review on this type of case. But since the Metcalf decision has been done in both the DeLeon case and the Santiago case, they talk about the plain error rule, the power to take plain errors or defects affecting substantial rights. So that still is in existence, no matter what the Metcalf case, which I think is kind of focused on maybe lesser trial errors. That's the word I would use. Whether that expert is qualified, maybe I don't think that goes perhaps far enough for the court to say, hey, they think, you know, this is just not enough.
But that case dealt with admission of evidence. In that case, it's different because, well, no, it's not different. It's the same. The evidence came in without objection, right?
My suggestion would be that the substantial rights test is still in existence. Schnabel is still a good law. It's been cited by both the DeLeon and Santiago. And clearly, court will, plain error standard, certainly ends of justice to prevent the denial of fundamental rights.
So given that standard, if we apply that standard, talk about the facts in this case and why is there substantial prejudice to your client, specifically by the admission of the Palmol photo, given the other evidence in the case?
Well, Your Honor, in terms of why this raises a difference, this is a constitutional issue. This is a search and seizure issue. This is Fourth Amendment type argument. Taking something from their home, the search and seizure is different, I would suggest, in terms of the penalty of rights that people have, as opposed to qualifying an expert.
So is your position that we should not consider the other evidence that may or may not link your client to the alleged crime? Should we not look at the other evidence in the plain error review?
I would suggest you do not. Judge, I think this is such a strong issue in this case. Both of these are such strong items that in terms of whether or not there is some evidence to find them guilty with a weak identification, our position would be this is the only evidence in town. I mean, we have the statements made, the disputed statements made that he made with the family that Carol disregards. But the only physical evidence we had is a photograph of the cigarettes. And as I point out in my brief, this was raised throughout by the state. It was raised in opening argument. Hey, she said she got rid of the cigarettes, and look what he had upon him. We have the testimony of the witnesses. We have her testimony of the cigarettes. And then we have the photographs of these cigarettes, all of which is not your normal discussion. So throughout the theme of this case, this has been one of the links to the defendant. The Palmol cigarettes taken from her in the car, found in his belongings, found in her possessions, and entered the photograph, entered in the evidence.
So to some extent, it is the importance of the evidence in terms of the plain error.
That's
review.
Not
okay.
I
just want to understand your position on it. Thank you. Thank you.
So, Your Honor, I think that is how I would state in terms of this, that this is something that is so obvious. It's not one of maybe a hidden issue somewhere. Well, you wouldn't see it, you wouldn't know it. They went up and said, hey, where's his stuff? When do you get it? This is clearly a seizure. This law of citing Supreme Court is over 10 years old. Other cases were. This is, I think, a pretty good case. That's why I think it's so important in this context of this case. And so additional important, I would suggest, is also the credit card. The credit card in this case, again, is one of the other piece of physical evidence that we had. Interestingly enough, the credit card was taken when the assault occurred on the 15th of September 2010. Officer Tahara testified that 2 days after the assault, he was sent out at 8 o'clock in the morning. And he said, instructed to search the rubbish cans in front of the residence in search of a credit card, looking for any evidence, in particular the credit card of Ms. Sky Badalona. That's docket 76, page 13, lines 1 to 10. That's the May 31st testimony.
Counsel, did you say in the front of the property?
I believe that's correct. And the rubbish cans fronting the residence.
Were there other rubbish cans on the property that you're aware of that's in the record?
No, Judge, this was, in terms of the entire property, this was one can standing by itself. Only one thing is important. This is not some big dumpster. This is a small, it's like one of those early kind of trash cans. It's like this big and this round.
Right, I believe there was exhibit 94 or 98, so we've seen the picture
right.
Of that rubbish can toward the front of the property. What I'm wondering is, were there other rubbish cans on the property?
Whether or not there are other ones, I don't I'm sorry. The answer is that I know that was the only one that was, this one was standing by itself. I'm saying that's it. There were nothing else around it. Whether or not physically on the property or any other rubbish can that dealt with probably look upon having that come back on the issue. But clearly it was by itself. The evidence will show face the street, it was toward the front of the property. You have a property here, and then you have the property which the defendant designed it. Toward facing the street was on the left side against the wall, not on the street. I want to be clear, it wasn't on the street, it wasn't some public trash can that you would use. It was on the property for the use of the tenants.
My question goes to whether a trash can at the front of the property adjacent to or nearby the house was whether the defendant had a reasonable expectation of privacy in a trash can sort of distant from the unit that he was in. So that's why I was asking about were there other trash cans.
There weren't. Not other trash cans near this one. In terms of the distance from that unit, we're talking a matter of not hundreds of yards, perhaps 20 yards. Not a huge distance at all. The trash can was used by the residents. And they just continue. At 8 o'clock, Officer Tahara came to go look, told him to go search the rubbish cans. It's found, and he went through the rubbish cans, and the car was found halfway into the rubbish cans, had to go through in order to get. Then we have the officer Ziong testified at 1:20 that same day, Sergeant instructed him to go with and check with the residents and ask if they had permission to check the trash can. So we have, at 8 o'clock in the morning, Officer Tahara comes there, goes to the trash can, and finds the car. Then the afternoon, we have Officer Inciong saying that at 1:20 he was sent there to go get permission out of the trash. Why are they getting permission to go to the trash if they didn't realize there were some issues here? Now, this is something that should have been done earlier. One of the persons they should have asked was my client. He resided there. They're asking other people, why not ask one of the people who resided there, namely my client?
So my question, Mr. Isaacson, would be that there's a front house, right? And then the apartments are in the back, and there's like a drive where there's parking between the structures, right?
Yes.
So as I understand the evidence, Alexis and Yolanda were going to move into the front house, and the trash can was next to the front house, right?
Yes.
And the apartment buildings are in the back, whatever it is, tens of yards in the back.
Yes,
very close.
Right.
But there's parking between the structures, right?
I don't want to say. Looking at the overhead, if you look at the overhead exhibit, there's better evidence, and I'm sorry, I'll
represent you. I mean, I've seen photos where I've seen cars parked between the structures, so it seems to me at least, assuming I'm looking at the photos correctly. But my question would be, given that your client, as I understand it, was residing in one of the units in the back apartment structures, what's the evidence of his actual expectation of privacy in the rubbish can that's next to the front house? What is the state of the evidence on that?
The evidence was that both Yolanda and Alexis and Carol both used the trash can. And they used it because that's how the testimony was how the car was initially discovered. They went to the trash can and they looked for a screen, I guess they would use it to repair whatever you used to repair.
The front house.
Right. So that was what was used not just by people in the front house, so they had an expectation of use of this trash can. And I think that he had a joint expectation that he resigned.
But in those cases, in Tanaka, there's consolidated cases, right? And The defendants owned the property, as I understand, or had some whatever. They the property, the trash cans were on their property, and the police came onto the property to search the trash cans. And so I think there actually is a determination there that there's evidence establishing the defendants in that in those cases actual expectations of privacy, because there's a subjective component, right, to the test, as I understand it from Tanaka. So what's the evidence as to your clients? Is there any evidence as to specifically your clients' actual expectation of privacy in those trash cans, in this trash can? So your argument would be any trash can on that property, no matter how big the property?
No.
Where would we draw the line?
Just there was one this size trash can that the Harold Lulu went for. They had an expectation. They used this trash can. It's the one they used. There wasn't some trash can that they never used in the far back of the property or no one ever saw. This is the closest one to the house, as far as I can tell, the one that they used. He was there permissively. We know the police later on came. All it says doesn't mean your police are powerful to search the defendant's bag. It simply means that absent exigent circumstances, the police have to get a search warrant.
Was there any evidence that the credit card was in an opaque container or it was just out in the trash can?
It was in trash underneath it. If you look at the photograph, there's some milk stuff that's stacked at the top. The testimony was in the trash. They had to dig it out. It wasn't the bottom. Certainly not just, you could look at it, it wasn't like you had to dig it out and go through it.
And that was Officer Tahara, you were saying, right? That's Officer Tahara's testimony?
Sorry, Your Honor. Officer Tahara was the one who obtained it, that is correct. And then Officer Insulin came back later to talk to the residents so they get permission to check the trash cans, which they shouldn't have done in the first place. And they should have just asked my client. I mean, you know, you resided there. You know you have to get permission to do it. And that's talking to the person who's the target of the investigation. I mean, yeah, clearly they were looking for something. Clearly they thought it was there for whatever reason. And they, you know, I think the law is pretty clear. They just need to go get a warrant so they can search it. Why would they then later come and ask for permission later on? Now, why not come to my client, who's a resident of this apartment? I'm going to skip past some of this stuff. I'm going to go to the ineffective assistance. Obviously, if you look at the brief, and by the way, I want to apologize for time. But for the Rule 40, most of those things, as you can tell, there's no sufficient record or evidence at the time. The Rule 40 type issue. However, in this case, you know, we have some significant issues. I must say, certainly a failure to file a motion to suppress the fruits of the illegal search in the defendant's room, his photo of a pack of cigarettes, failure to file a motion to suppress the fruits of the illegal search of the trash can and object to the admission of the credit card, failure to request instruction of eyewitness testimony, I know the bag is subsequent to this, but I know, I can't remember the name of the newest case, they just can't, they're doing so well, but the newest case, which follows the bag. I know it's not retroactive, but there seems to be a use of discretion. Clearly, I think in this case, cries out for instruction of eyewitness testimony. Certainly, I think one should have been done in this case. And the failure to challenge the idea of the defendant, when you have these difficulties of the identification, and then you have a situation where she actually testifies, oh yeah, I identified the defendant. I sure did. That was me. I identified him. The detective has to go against him. I'm sorry, that's not me who identified. You identified somebody else. Poor woman doesn't even know she identified the person. And to not object to this kind of identification, is, I would suggest there are most of this is Rule 40 stuff, but it comes a point of honor. Certainly tactical decisions are respected by this court, and I understand this, but I would suggest to you none of these type things that I'm talking about.
Well, was your brief served on the trial defense counsel? Don't they have an opportunity to respond?
I did, Judge.
Okay.
No, initially, the first brief I did, I think, I would say that my first brief was, I did supplement it, sure.
Well, it's in the record one way or the other, right? Okay. Thank you.
And the only thing I'll add to that, I don't believe that is that this is not a secret, but she was very ill, we don't talk about that in most of the other night. And I think, I don't know if that had an attribution to this, I know, when we look through the minutes, but certainly there were continuous as many in this case to be very illness before this trial. I don't know if that's a contributor, I don't mean to jump on trial counsel. You know, I know how difficult it is, but when I see these type of decisions that are made to not object to this type of evidence, credit card, trash can, cigarettes, identification, I have to suggest that we have difficulties.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Booth.
With the court's indulgence, I would like to make a few prefatory remarks. In order to address the serious accusations leveled against the trial court, as well as defense counsel, I will impute information to the trial court and the defense counsel based on the record as presently developed. Moreover, I will present my remarks with the following considerations in mind. The first one would be, as the Supreme Court stated in State versus Mendoza, that's at 121 Hawaii 368, which is that we must assume that an attorney will observe the responsibilities to the legal system as well as their client. Secondly, this court's ICA, the opinion of the ICA in Pasquale at 2010 Westlaw 370-5993 at page 3, where it says, the trial judges are presumed to know the law and apply the law in making their decisions. Next, the assumption that the ICA set forth in Lee at 1YF515, which is we necessarily approach a case with the assumption that no error has been committed upon the trial until this assumption has been overcome by a positive showing. And then at least two significant rules of professional conduct, some of which the language is testy. The first one is 3.1, which I call the good faith basis rule for a counsel to make an assertion or controverted position. It has to have a good faith basis in the fact and the law. And the second rule is rule 3.381, which I believe states that a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of material fact or the law. At no time during this argument am I accusing anyone of knowingly doing anything because I don't read minds? But I will make observations based on the record which I believe to suggest there are material misstatements of fact and or the law. Unless you have a specific concern, I'd like to first address the cigarettes.
Please proceed.
With respect to the cigarettes, I believe counsel's position is basically, as he stated here and he stated in his brief, that under the Hawaii Constitution, an overnight guest has a guaranteed right of access in the apartment of the host, even though the host gives consent, citing for that proposition State versus Matias. My position is that I believe that the trial counsel, as well as the court, would have known that that's a misstatement of the law. Because actually, the law that's applicable at the time of trial, which had been the law in this jurisdiction for more than two decades, should be State versus Mahone at 67 Hawaii 644. Mahone specifically distinguishes Matias and makes clear that there is no absolute guarantee right of privacy for a guest, and that the host, assuming that host has actual authority, can consent to a search of the apartment. Actual authority is measured against the foregoing standard. Whether that host had access to the premise and one or more of the following: common authority over the premise, a substantial interest over the premise, and or permission to exercise access. The facts as known to the defense counsel in this case would have made clear that the police did not just go into the bedroom, that the police got the consent, that the police got the consent of Alexis, as well as Darlene Cruz, her mother, both individuals who lived in the apartment before the defendant came in. Moreover, the testimony of Carol would have made crystal clear to the defendant that, to defense counsel, that Carol, defendant, and Carol's child, Brianna, before they were allowed to move into Alexis's apartment, had to get her permission. In fact, Carol said she had to beg and beg and beg Alexis to get permission, and when it finally came, it was with the agreement that they would have to follow a plethora of rules. Moreover, the evidence known to defense counsel was they were allowed to stay in the kids' bedroom. The kids also were in the apartment. So to suggest that there was some reason to file a motion to suppress based upon a violation of defendant's right of privacy upon the entry of the room, that's just not true. And Mahone would make that clear. Moreover, defense counsel as well as the trial court would have known that with respect to these privacy right motions, that the controlling law would be State versus, I believe it's pronounced Ta'ua. It's at 98 Hawaii 426. And what that controlling Supreme Court precedent makes clear is that in this jurisdiction, we rejected the federal automatic standing provision, and instead, we adopted the Supreme Court's test set forth in RAKS, R-A-K-S, as well as CATS. And so what that means is that the defendant, to prevail on a motion to suppress, and therefore counsel to bring the motion to suppress under a good faith basis on Rule 3.1, would have to know that as that proponent of that motion, she would have to show by a preponderance of the evidence these two factors. That defendant himself had an actual expectation of privacy in the bedroom, and that's one society is not prepared, is prepared to recognize as reasonable. Okay. On this record, defendant never testified. So the facts as known to defense counsel in the court would have indicated the police got the consent from the proper people. So now we're inside the bedroom. Secondarily, the information known to defense counsel in the court would have made clear that the cigarettes were contained within a woman's handbag. Now let me clarify this exhibit. This was received as State's Exhibit 125, and they testified, from Officer Young, in Sion testified, that the cigarettes seemed to have come from this purse, a woman's purse, as well as this exhibit. State's Exhibit 144, and through Detective Platt, it would have made clear that defense counsel was under the belief that the cigarettes came from this purse. Also, the evidence known to defense counsel would have known, moreover, that it's a woman's purse, and specifically through the testimony of Carol as well as Detective Platt, that the purse belonged to Carol. When they seized it and then concluded it had no evidentiary value, both Detective Platt said it returned to Carol, and Carol testified that she went to the police to pick it up. Now, why that would become relevant to defense counsel and the judge, there again, under Ta'ua and Mahone, defendant, as was his right, didn't testify, but then there's absolutely no evidence to indicate that he had any possessory interest over the purse. And Ta'ua makes very clear, you cannot bring a motion properly under 3.1 with a good faith basis asserting my rights to privacy were violated because Carol's right to privacy was violated. That the counsel would know, I can't do that. I can't ethically bring that motion. So therefore, counsel wouldn't have brought a motion to suppress the cigarettes. Moreover, and as I stated in the brief, and as the court seems to be aware of, there's other evidence with respect to the linking the cigarettes to the defendant. But I don't believe you get to a harmless error argument until you get to a point in the record where counsel should have known the defendant had an actual subjective expectation of privacy and the person didn't own it.
Okay. Now, If we found that he had an actual subjective right to privacy in the bedroom, before we get to the purse, how would that affect your argument?
I would say that still the entry of the photograph of the purse is still harmless error, because Alexis testified that when they went to pick the defendant up, he had Pall Mall cigarettes. So I think it's harmless. I mean, but I would never concede that defense counsel was ineffective for not believing on the evidence and information known to her that defendant had a right of privacy in the bedroom, when the testimony shows the police got consent from two different individuals who lived in the house, Alexa, which is the only person on the lease, as well as her mother, Darlene Cruz. I don't know how defense counsel, with that evidence, would have thought, yeah, the consent was ineffective. There were eight people living in that apartment. I would suggest it's rather crowded.
Mr. Fudo, just so I understand the cases that you're arguing, because I'm looking at your answering brief and I don't see Mahone, or is it Tahua?
I call it Tahua, T-A-O-K-I-N-A.
Okay.
Glaustop, U-A.
Oh, Tahua.
Sorry.
Gotcha, okay.
And
give me the site for Tahua, please. If you could give me the site, please.
It's at 98 Hawaii 426.
Thank you.
I anticipated that might have been a concern of the court, and I'd like to say this. If you look at the opening brief, as with respect to the accusation regarding ineffective assistance of counsel, and you look at the reply brief, the accusations of ineffective assistance of counsel with regard to the cigarette, the person ID, they weren't raised in the opening brief. They were raised for the first time in the reply brief. That's why I didn't cite the case.
I recognize that. Thank you.
Thank you. Turning next now to the credit card. Counsel says in his brief that defendant had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the trash cans outside his residence, and then citing Tanaka. At first, the state would acknowledge that a person does have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their trash. However, the evidence in this record makes clear that there were two sets of trash cans. There was a set of trash cans for these apartments, and there was a separate trash can for the house fronting the house that fronted the apartment building.
Is there testimony as to that point, or are we merely just referencing the picture?
Here's the testimony, Your Honor.
By the way, is that exhibit 98, I think?
This is exhibit 94.
Four.
And in reference to this exhibit, the deputy prosecutor asked Officer Tahala what it was, what this reference. And he said it shows the driveway to the fronting residence, which was separate from the driveway to where Mr. Smith's unit was. Moreover, the testimony of Officer Incione makes crystal clear, it would have made crystal clear to the defendant and the court, that with respect to the apartments the trash cans associated with the apartment, they got written consent to search those from two tenants of the apartment, and they found nothing. And that's at the docket at docket number 77, pages 38, lines 18 through 25, page 39, 1 through 2. Separately, the testimony of Officer Tahala makes clear that the trash can for the front house belonged to Alexis, and he so testified as so, that it was her trash can and not the one for the apartment building, and that's the trash can in which the card was just set there. So there again, counsel, with that information, just a moment, please. With that information and knowledge of the relevant case law, counsel would have thought to herself, okay, if the trash can in which the card was found belongs to the house fronting the residence, then defendant, my client, I'm sorry, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in that trash can. It was as the situation in Ta'ua noted, that when a defendant, assuming they have a possessory interest in an item, places it in a location that's readily accessible to the public, that any subjective expectation of privacy he might believe he has, society won't recognize that as reasonable.
Mr. Foodle, a clarification. Did you say that there was a search warrant issued for the trash can that's in that picture, Exhibit 94, that's on the left-hand side of the apartment unit? Is that So the search warrant issued?
Written consent.
There was no search warrant.
Okay,
there was written consent by two tenants who lived in this apartment. And why that becomes relevant under Mahone, which defense counsel would have known, you can presume she knew, is that when there's this common access authority situation, the law, well, the precedent says the police need only get consent from one such person. And
my question is more specific to, in terms of the consent, which of the trash cans are you talking about?
The trash cans that the testimony indicated belonged to the apartment building.
Okay, the one that's in Exhibit 94 on the left-hand side of the apartment building. Is that
yes,
the
trash? Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
Because the credit card, as I understand the evidence, was on the right-hand side of the front house, in a trash can on the right-hand side of the front house. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Which is not depicted in this photo, in Exhibit 94, but is in some other photos.
Correct.
Okay.
So the trash can is belonging to Alexis. She had the reasonable expectation under Tanaka of that. So defendant having no reasonable expectation of privacy in Alexis' trash can, defense counsel would have known that under Rule 0.1, I have no good faith basis to bring a motion to suppress. I can't. It just wasn't yours. So on that basis, neither the defense counsel was ineffective in the court, for both reasons or reasons that I've explained, wouldn't have sua sponte refused to accept the items of the cigarette and or the credit card into evidence when it was so offered by the prosecutor. There would be no law or facts to justify that decision to be made, and therefore there's no ineffective assistance of counsel and there's no plain error. And I believe that under the Mondone standard with respect to defense counsel's responsibility to the legal system as well as their client, they're not going to file things based on misrepresentations of fact or not knowing the law. I just don't think it's fair to put that burden on defense trial counsel.
So you're focusing on the ineffective assistance of counsel argument right now. What about the plain error review that Mr. Isaacson suggests we should review, that we should analyze the admission of both the Pall Mall cigarettes and the credit card? What is your take in terms of how we should address that analysis, and does the weight of the other evidence, what role does the weight of the other evidence play?
I think the weight of the other evidence turns it not from plain error, but harmless error. Because I think plain error, first you have, defense counsel has to be shown to have erred. I don't think that's there. But if the court is asking me to assume for the sake of argument that there was error, I think there was other very compelling evidence with respect to both the credit card and the cigarette. The cigarette, I've already explained, Alexa testified it was there when he came into the car. With respect to the credit card, you had Alexis, who's a witness for the prosecution, Carol, a witness for the defense, they found the credit card. They testified they found the credit card in that rubbish can. So even if the actual credit card wasn't admitted into evidence, there would be no reason to suppress their testimony that, yes, we found the credit card about halfway down in that trash can. That would still have come in.
And they both testified that the name of the complaining witness was on the credit card.
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel,
yes.
Mr. Isaacson also discussed that this is a weak identification case and that the Pall Malls and the credit card are the only physical evidence, and because it's search and seizure evidence, that we should give it additional weight when we consider whether the defendant's substantial rights were violated here. How do you respond to that? Goes to the weak evidence. You know, he's saying this is a weak identification case, so it isn't harmless because this is the only physical evidence.
Okay, I agree that it's the only physical evidence, but it certainly is not the only evidence. Counsel submitted a Rule 28J briefing letter, I guess within the last 2 weeks. One of the cases he cited was Walton. And I believe that that's significant because in Walton, we had kind of a similar issue where the court said, you know, really, why are we so much concerned with that identification when we had other evidence of identification? In Walton, it was one. Here, it was two. You had the news broadcast of this heinous crime aired. And while it's aired, Alexa confronts defendant, and he admits, yeah, I robbed, but I swear in my kid's life, I didn't rape. Yolanda heard the same admission by the defendant. Now, I acknowledge that Carol said she controverted that. He never said that. But that is other very significant evidence. Moreover, you have the testimony of the Detective Platt, who said that he withheld key details regarding the crime from the public, and that when Alexa came to him and spoke about her concern that defendant had admitted to doing it, she revealed crimes that, she revealed details that in his mind, only the perpetrator would have known. So, yeah, there was only those physical evidence, but there was certainly other compelling evidence that the jury as fact finder could have used to determine, no, identification was made. Actually, Mr. Smith, you were the one that perpetrated these crimes.
Mr. Fudo, the only 28J letter that I believe I've seen from Mr. Isaacson, I don't see a reference to Walton. What is the Walton case that you're referencing? I think you mentioned Walton, and to deal with the harmless error. Can I just get your cite? I want to make sure I'm understanding your argument.
Okay, here's the electronically filed copy of it. It was 28J.
I have a different citation.
I have
one that was filed just a few days ago. So what is the citation there?
He cites Walton number 4 at 133 Hawaii 66.
Okay, thank you.
It was a two-page letter, Your Honor.
Okay.
And what is the date of the letter, just to clarify?
The date of the letter is July 18th, 2014, 12:33 p.m.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. With respect to what I think is, you know, a rather interesting issue that defense counsel initially hasn't discussed, was the merger. Now, under State versus Hoey, with respect to a kidnapping and robbery, I believe the holding basically provided that when a kidnapping extends beyond the acts of kidnapping that the defendant necessarily and incidentally committed during the robbery, the kidnapping and the robbery don't merge. Clearly, the facts as known to defense counsel in this case would be that he first physically grabs the victim, takes her in and about the area at the bottom of the steps, through threat of force while committing a robbery, does so to get her to acquiesce to his taking of her possessions. He takes the possessions. The restraint continues. It continues with threat of force and actual force, such that he's then able to perpetrate the sexual assault upon her. If that's all we have in this case, I don't think there's an issue between a merger between the robbery and the kidnapping. However, I recognize what the interrogatories seem to indicate, and I further would recognize, at least my reading of Hoey, didn't seem to contemplate that. I recognize that the negative response to the interrogatory would suggest merger, but the positive response would indicate no merger. So, please, I really have no idea why people did or did not do anything with respect to those answers to those interrogatories when you had two consistent answers to the interrogatory with respect to the kidnapping and the sexual assault, i.e. a yes, yes. But in the event that this court assumes or finds that as a result of the interrogatory answers there's a merger, the case law in this jurisdiction says it merges up. And ironically, in the 28J letter that the defense counsel submitted, he cites a case there, State versus Santiago at 131 Hawaii 353. I believe it was authored by Justice Acoba, and it's consistent with the position that the state took in its brief that under the ICA's decision in Tomomitsu, which recognizes Jamila, and the law to be as following for a violation of a 701-109 issue. It merges up, and as equity has it, that's fair to the defendant because he's fairly convicted of both, there's evidence for both, and it's fair to both the prosecution and importantly the public, victim being among that group. Defense counsel did not cite authority, and I couldn't find authority that says it merges down. So if you find the merger, we're still left with the kidnapping, and we're still left with the sexual assault. And when the court discusses, just a moment, the justification for the imposition of the consecutive sentences, It's because the court definitely felt that the kidnap was committed first and separately from the sexual assault, and almost as like a heinous afterthought, the judge said it will run it consecutively. Quote, the nature and circumstances of the offenses indicated that the offenses were committed in a cruel manner with viciousness displayed. The jury specifically found that the sexual assault and the kidnapping did not merge, and I believe the interrogatories are consistent with that finding of the court. In other words, they were separate offenses. Additionally, the victim was not voluntarily released by the defendant, but instead escaped by her own efforts. That becomes pertinent because that is the reason their answers to the interrogatories regarding the kidnapping made it kidnapping as an A and not kidnapping as a B. If it was kidnapping as a B, then under Santiago, Justice Acoba said, you know, either one, because they're the same offenses. But he clearly said and recognized Jamila, as did Tomomitsu, that when they merge, they should merge up so the conviction for the most severe offense will stand. I had an afterthought with respect to the ID issue also. Although Cabinaton, I believe that's the case that the defense counsel was referring to, and he also cited in his 28-J letter, as well as Kabagbag says the new rule was purely prospective, it seems like Judge Pollack had a little bit of foresight, and with respect to the identification issue, on his own, if I can have just a second, on his own, he added this paragraph, which at the time wasn't required under Hodges, and I quote, the prosecution has the burden of proving every material element of the offense's charge. This burden includes proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was the person who committed the offense's charge. If after examining all of the evidence you have a reasonable doubt as to whether the defendant was the person who committed the offense's charge, then you must find the defendant not guilty. So under the law, at the time that this case was tried, the question is whether the jury's attention was adequately drawn to the identification issue. As I set forth in my brief, and as I'll reiterate here just briefly, defense counsel in her opening statement made it clear to the jury that ID was the issue, we have the wrong guy. In her copious cross of victim, at docket 76, page 107, 60, 15, she grilled the victim on her ID and the peculiarities of not being able to defend him. Also, you have the jury instructions which the court said in Kabagbag were sufficient to bring the jury's attention to the identification issue, namely, the probability or improbability of the identification, and this time it would be in court, moreover, that they were to assess the credibility of the witness, the manner and opportunity which he could get information upon which to make the ID. And in this particular case, it was clear that she said when he went to the top of the stairs, the light was there, her attention was fixed on him, which rightfully should be, as the case facts indicate, she was looking and waiting for an opportunity to escape. Then in closing argument, counsel reiterated, we have the wrong guy, she misidentified him in the lineups. And then the prosecutor brought it home to the jury, the ID issue, in her rebuttal, trying or attempting to explain why it is that the victim picked the wrong person out of the ID. So to suggest that the ID is an issue, I don't believe is fair to defense counsel. And again, on that issue, I don't believe defense counsel was ineffective for not filing a motion to suppress. Globally, although I believe that there's been false statements of material fact and on the law, I'm not saying anybody did those knowingly. Moreover, and unfortunately, in this jurisdiction, it has come to be that the Supreme Court does not allow a defense counsel to file an Anders brief. So I don't know, and I'm in no position to know, why certain things were alleged, but I have friends that are defense counsel that sometimes are forced to acquiesce to the wishes of their client, and they're just being unreasonable, so they just have to put what they put in the brief. So I think there's a tension between the defense counsel not being able to file an Anders brief and their responsibility under Rule 3.1 to have a good faith basis for their arguments. That being said, I just want to make it clear I'm not accusing anyone of anything, but the record speaks for itself and shows clearly that only as the facts were known to Ms. Loy at the time of trial and to Judge Pollack as the trial judge, I think fairness dictates not a finding that they did anything improper. Moreover, I make that point, and I hopefully have stressed that, because I understand that the court can not accept the accusations without prejudice for leave to file a Rule 40. However, it's also been my experience that when that is written, defendants a lot of times take that as the the red light to start filing the Rule 40s. And I would rather not be stated, more so because the rule doesn't require that concession or acknowledgement by the court in order for a defense counsel to file a Rule 40. Unless there's other questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Exception to that. The quick to pay decision the court I have, if I'm incorrect, I please point out I'm wrong. An overnight guest was guaranteed the right to privacy in this host apartment, even though the host consented to a search. That's not something I'm making up. If I've misquoted, that's fine. But the idea that somehow I'm misreading this court or taking this court down some primrose path of deception, I don't think so. I don't think this is the only case that talks like this, and I don't truly don't appreciate the kind of idea that I'm misleading this court in terms of the standard of review in that regard. In terms of the facts of what occurred, clearly he was not present at the time they took his stuff. The officers were sent, go get his stuff, they went to get it. He was not there to consent. He resided there. There's no question about these facts. The question somehow that I'm misleading, I don't understand. Now, perhaps there's other exceptions that I'm not aware of, but I believe they had to have a warrant to go take his stuff.
Mr. Isaacson, just to give you a fair chance, Mr. Fudo brings up the Mahone case and the Ta'ua case, which were not in the briefs, and he suggested there's a reason for that. But to the extent that you want to comment on those cases, we'll obviously go study them. But
I can only say this. I've had a litigated case recently in regard to this type of issue in front of Judge Hahn, who did a jury trial recently on it. Mm-hmm. I believe the Kudape case, it was a guy at a poker party, and the police came up, and he ran into the back of the washroom, stuck something behind the washing machine, and said, no, you can't go get that. You can't go pull the machine out, because he has the, what's the correct term, the halo, maybe that's the right word, of the home ownership regard as a guest to the place. This is not some crazy thing I am getting up to, if I may. In regard to the testimony or the statement that Officer Incheon indicated that cigarettes were in the Gucci bag, that is completely not. I don't believe that's in the record. I believe there's a photograph that shows the pack of cigarettes near it. Officer Incheon's testimony was nothing to the extent that it was found in any specific bag whatsoever. But the idea that somehow it was, we could argue, or that it somehow it was in her bag or her purse, there's absolutely no testimony. I have seen nothing to that effect in the testimony of the grand jury that I have reviewed in regard to this case. In terms of the issue of whether or not Alexis had let me back up. I took some quick notes. The officer Tahara indicated on page, the testimony on May 31st, I think it's 76, page 30, there was only one can that he searched and only one can he noticed. I don't know if that helps on the question that we had before about the number of cans, but that was his testimony. One can he searched, only a can that he noticed.
I think my question was really, as Exhibit 94 indicates, there was another trash can on the property next to the apartment building in the back left corner.
Okay.
And I think as Judge Reifert was trying to understand from his questioning is, were there multiple trash cans? You don't dispute that the credit card that was put into evidence was found in the trash can that was on the side, the right-hand side of the front house, right? Okay. So there's no dispute about that.
No, I think it was a question of there other cans.
Right.
The officer said there was none around. He saw, he was pointing right to
this
can.
My thinking on that is simply that it goes to the question of what actual expectation of privacy your client had in the front trash can, especially if there are multiple trash cans on the property.
Well, Your Honor, I can say is I believe Alexis testified that she used the trash can. They all used this trash can. This is the trash they went to in order to dispose of their garbage. And there's no indication that there's a separate trash for the front house and one for another place. This is where they put the stuff. You know, Alexis, they had to control the front house and move it into it. This is where they put their trash. And that goes, she was still residing with the defendant at the time when they came to examine this trash can. So Alexis, Carol, Yolanda, all resided there.
Weren't they in the process of renovating that front house or somehow getting it ready?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there any other, what's the best testimony that you can point to that, just as a general tenant of the back apartment buildings, that they use this particular trash can?
Carol went there. Okay. They went there, Carol, and Alexis went there. That's where Carol lived with the defendant. That's where they went to go search this, to try to find this screen to use to repair. I would say it's a joint place to use for the trash can. This is, I mean, Carol was there. Why would she be going to the trash can? She didn't use it. So I think it's fair to say certainly they used it. And certainly, I think it's better to be entitled to use it as well.
It might be helpful for you to address the merger issue, counsel.
Regarding the merger, Your Honor, the jury's interrogatory came back indicating they're not separate intents. I think it speaks for itself. There was a reason for the jury instruction. The jury instruction says you had to find unanimously, and they did. They did not. So the question, I guess the answer is, was that somehow a crazy verdict? No. I think the fact that the testimonies, these things occur so quickly in time, the jury could say, hey, there's just no separate intents. Well, that is separate intents.
What about Mr. Fudo's argument that any merger merges up and therefore the effect in this case is...
No, I will concur. In terms of the recent cases spoke of, he's... I wish I could take a good argument to tell you no, but I think the evidence of the case law is clear that it does merge.
We appreciate that, counsel.
I think that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Anything else? Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement.